that they were valuable and were intended to be retained. Giving them away would have been an affront. But the indigenous people understood the value of the gift to be based in reciprocity and would be affronted if the gifts did not circulate back to them. Many of our ancient teachings counsel that whatever we have been given is supposed to be given away again. From the viewpoint of a private property economy, the gift is deemed to be free because we obtain it free of charge at no cost. But in the gift economy, gifts are not free. The essence of the gift is that it creates a set of relationships. The currency of a gift economy is at its root reciprocity. In Western thinking, private land is understood to be a bundle of rights, whereas in a gift economy, property has a bundle of responsibilities attached. I was once lucky enough to spend time doing ecological research in the Andes. My favorite part was market day at the local village when the square filled with vendors. There were tables loaded with plátanos, carts of fresh papaya, stalls in bright colors with pyramids of tomatoes, and buckets of hairy yucca roots. Other vendors spread blankets on the ground with everything you could need, from flip-flops to woven palm hats. Squatting behind her red blanket, a woman in a striped shawl and navy blue bowler spread out medicinal roots as beautifully wrinkled as she was. The colors, the smells of corn roasting on a wood fire and sharp limes, and the sounds of all the voices mingle wonderfully in my memory. I had a favorite stall where the owner, Edita, looked for me each day. She'd kindly explain how to cook unfamiliar items and pull out the sweetest pineapple she'd been saving under the table. And once she even had strawberries. I know I paid the gringa prices, but the experience of abundance and goodwill were worth every peso. I dreamed not long ago of that market, with all its vivid textures. I walked through the stalls with a basket over my arm, and as always, went right to Edita for a bunch of fresh cilantro. We chatted and laughed, and when I held up my coins, she waved them off, patting my arm and sending me away. "A gift," she said. "Muchas gracias, señora," I replied. There was my favorite panadera, with clean cloths laid over the round loaves. I chose a few rolls, opened my purse, and this vendor, too, gestured away my money, as if I were impolite to suggest paying. I looked around in bewilderment. This was my familiar market, and yet everything had changed. And it wasn't just for me. No shopper was paying. I floated through the market with a sense of euphoria. Gratitude was the only currency accepted here. It was all a gift. It was like picking strawberries in my field. The merchants were just intermediaries, passing on gifts from the earth. I looked in my basket. Two zucchinis, an onion, tomatoes, bread, and a bunch of cilantro. It was still half empty, but it felt full. I had everything I needed. I glanced over at the cheese stall, thinking to get some. But knowing it would be given, not sold, I decided I could do without. It's funny. Had all the things in the market merely been a very low price, I probably would have scooped up as much as I could. But when everything became a gift, I felt self-restraint. I didn't want to take too much. And I began thinking of what small presents I might bring to the vendors tomorrow. The dream faded, of course, but the feelings, first of euphoria and then of self-restraint, remain. I've thought of it often and recognize now that I was witness there to the conversion of a market economy to a gift economy, from private goods to common wealth. And in that transformation, the relationships became as nourishing as the food I was getting. Across the market stalls and blankets, warmth and compassion were changing hands. There was a shared celebration of abundance for all we'd been given. And since every market basket contained a meal, there was justice. I'm a plant scientist, and I want to be clear. But I'm also a poet, and the world speaks to me in metaphor. When I speak of the gift of berries, I do not mean that Frigeria virginiana has been up all night making a present just for me, strategizing to find exactly what I'd like on a summer morning. So far as we know, that does not happen. But as a scientist, I'm well aware of how little we do know. The plant has in fact been up all night, assembling little packets of sugar and seeds and fragrance and color, because when it does so, its evolutionary fitness is increased. When it is successful in enticing an animal such as me to disperse its fruit, its genes for making yumminess are passed on to ensuing generations with a higher frequency than those of the plant whose berries were inferior. The berries made by the plant shape the behaviors of the dispersers and have adaptive consequences. What I mean, of course, is that our human relationship with strawberries is transformed by our choice of perspective. It is human perception that makes the world a gift. When we view the world this way, strawberries and humans alike are transformed. The relationship of gratitude and reciprocity thus developed can increase the evolutionary fitness of both plant and animal. A species and a culture that treat the natural world with respect and reciprocity will surely pass on genes to ensuing generations with a higher frequency than the people who destroy it. The stories we choose to shape our behaviors have adaptive consequences. Lewis Hyde has made extensive studies of gift economies. He finds that objects will remain plentiful because they are treated as gifts. A gift relationship with nature is a formal give and take that acknowledges our participation in and dependence upon natural increase. We tend to respond to nature as a part of ourselves, not a stranger or alien available for exploitation. Gift exchange is the commerce of choice, for it is commerce that harmonizes with or participates in the process of nature's increase. In the old times, when people's lives were so directly tied to the land, it was easy to know the world as gift. When fall came, the skies would darken with flocks of geese, honking, "Here we are!" It reminds the people of the creation story, when the geese came to save Sky Woman. The people are hungry, winter is coming, and the geese fill the marshes with food. It is a gift, and the people receive it with thanksgiving, love, and respect. But when the food does not come from a flock in the sky, when you don't feel the warm feathers cool in your hand, and know that a life has been given for yours, when there is no gratitude in return, that food may not satisfy. It may leave the spirit hungry while the belly is full. Something is broken when the food comes on a styrofoam tray wrapped in slippery plastic, a carcass of a being whose only chance at life was a cramped cage. That is not a gift of life. It's a theft. How in our modern world can we find our way to understand the earth as a gift again, to make our relations with the world sacred again? I know we cannot all become hunter-gatherers. The living world could not bear our weight. But even in a market economy, can we behave as if the living world were a gift? We could start by listening to Wally. There are those who will try to sell the gifts. But as Wally says of sweetgrass for sale, don't buy it. Refusal to participate is a moral choice. Water is a gift for all, not meant to be bought and sold. Don't buy it. When food has been wrenched from the earth, depleting the soil and poisoning our relatives in the name of higher yields, don't buy it. In material fact, strawberries belong only to themselves. The exchange relationships we choose determine whether we share them as a common gift or sell them as a private commodity. A great deal rests on that choice. For the greater part of human history, and in places in the world today, common resources were the rule. But someone invented a different story, a social construct in which everything is a commodity to be bought and sold. The market economy story has spread like wildfire, with uneven results for human well-being and devastation for the natural world. But it is just a story we have told ourselves, and we are free to tell another, to reclaim the old one. One of these stories sustains the living systems on which we depend. One of these stories opens the way to living in gratitude and amazement at the richness and generosity of the world. One of these stories asks us to bestow our own gifts in kind, to celebrate our kinship with the world. We can choose. If all the world is a commodity, how poor we grow. When all the world is a gift in motion, how wealthy we become. In those childhood fields waiting for strawberries to ripen, I used to eat the sour white ones, sometimes out of hunger, but mostly from impatience. I knew the long-term results of my short-term greed, but I took them anyway. Fortunately, our capacity for self-restraint grows and develops like the berries beneath the leaves, so I learned to wait a little. I remember lying on my back in the fields, watching the clouds go by, and rolling over to check the berries every few minutes. When I was young, I thought the change might happen that fast. Now I am old, and I know that transformation is slow. The commodity economy has been here on Turtle Island for 400 years, eating up the white strawberries and everything else. But people have grown weary of the sour taste in their mouths. A great longing is upon us to live again in a world made of gifts. I can sense it coming, like the fragrance of ripening strawberries rising on the breeze. An offering. Our people were canoe people, until they made us walk, until our lakeshore lodges were signed away for shanties and dust. Our people were a circle, until we were dispersed. Our people shared a language with which to thank the day, until they made us forget. But we didn't forget. Not quite. Most summer mornings of childhood, I woke to the sound of the outhouse door, the squeak of the hinge followed by the hollow thunk as it shut. I rose to consciousness through the hazy songs of vireos and thrushes, the lapping of the lake, and finally the sound of my father pumping the tank on the Coleman stove. By the time my brothers and sisters and I emerged from our sleeping bags, the sun would be just topping the eastern shore, pulling mist off the lake in long white coils. The small 4-cup coffee pot of battered aluminum, blackened with the smoke of many fires, would already be thumping. Our family spent summers canoe camping in the Adirondacks, and every day began this way. I can picture my father, in his red-checked wool shirt, standing atop the rocks above the lake. When he lifts the coffee pot from the stove, morning bustle stops. We know without being told that it's time to pay attention. He stands at the edge of camp with the coffee pot in his hands, holding the top in place with a folded pot holder. He pours coffee out on the ground in a thick brown stream. The sunlight catches the flow, striping it amber and brown and black as it falls to the earth and steams in the cool morning air. With his face to the morning sun, he pours and speaks into the stillness. Here's to the gods of Tahoas. The stream runs down over smooth granite to merge with the lake water, as clear and brown as the coffee. I watch it trickle, picking up bits of pale lichen and soaking a tiny clump of moss as it follows a crack to the water's edge. The moss swells with the liquid and unfurls its leaves to the sun. Then, and only then, does he pour out steaming cups of coffee for himself and for my mother, who stands at the stove making pancakes. So begins each morning in the North Woods, the words that come before all else. I was pretty sure that no other family I knew began their day like this, but I never questioned the source of those words, and my father never explained. They were just part of our life among the lakes. But their rhythm made me feel at home, and the ceremony drew a circle around our family. By those words, we said, "Here we are." And I imagined that the land heard us, murmured to itself, "Oh, here are the ones who know how to say thank you." Tahoas is the Algonquin name for Mount Marcy, the highest peak in the Adirondacks. It's called Mount Marcy to commemorate a governor who never set foot on those wild slopes. Tahoas, the cloud splitter, is its true name, invoking its essential nature. Among our Potawatomi people, there are public names and true names. True names are used only by intimates and in ceremony. My father had been on Tahoas' summit many times and knew it well enough to call it by name, speaking with intimate knowledge of the place and the people who came before. When we call a place by name, it is transformed from wilderness to homeland. I imagine that this beloved place knew my true name as well, even when I myself did not. Sometimes my father would name the gods of Forked Lake, or South Pond, or Brandybrook Flow, wherever our tents were settled for the night. I came to know that each place was inspirited, was home to others before we arrived and long after we left. As he called out the names and offered a gift, the first coffee, he quietly taught us the respect we owed these other beings and how to show our thanks for summer mornings. I knew that in the long ago times, our people raised their thanks in morning songs, in prayer, and the offering of sacred tobacco. But at that time, in our family history, we didn't have sacred tobacco, and we didn't know the songs. They'd been taken away from my grandfather at the doors of the boarding school. But history moves in a circle. And here we were, the next generation, back to the loon-filled lakes of our ancestors, back to canoes. My mother had her own more pragmatic ritual of respect, the translation of reverence and intention into action. Before we paddled away from any camping place, she made us kids scour the place to be sure that it was spotless. No burnt matchstick, no scrap of paper escaped her notice. "Leave this place better than you found it," she admonished. And so we did. And we also had to leave wood for the next person's fire, with tinder and kindling carefully sheltered from rain by a sheet of birch bark. I like to imagine their pleasure, those other paddlers, arriving after dark to find a ready pile of fuel to warm their evening meal. My mother's ceremony connected us to them, too. The offering was made only under an open sky and never back in town where we lived. On Sundays, when other kids would go to church, my folks would take us out along the river to look for herons and muskrats, to the woods to hunt for spring flowers or on picnics. The words came along. For our winter picnics, we would walk all morning on snowshoes and then build a fire in the center of a circle stomped down with our webbed feet. This time the pot was full of bubbling tomato soup, and the first draft poured was for the snow. Here's to the gods of Tahoas. Only then would we wrap mittened hands around our steaming cups. And yet, as I grew to adolescence, the offering began to leave me angry or sad. The circle that had brought me a sense of belonging turned inside out. I heard in the words a message that we did not belong because we spoke in the language of exiles. It was a secondhand ceremony, Somewhere there were people who knew the rite ceremony, who knew the lost language and spoke the true names, including my own. But still, every morning I watched the coffee disappear into the crumbly brown humus, as if returning to itself. In the same way that the flow of coffee down the rock opened the leaves of the moss, ceremony brought the quiescent back to life, opened my mind and heart to what I knew but had forgotten. The words and the coffee called us to remember that these woods and lakes were a gift. Ceremonies large and small have the power to focus attention to a way of living awake in the world. The visible became invisible, merging with the soil. It may have been a secondhand ceremony, but even through my confusion, I recognized that the earth drank it up as if it were right. The land knows you, even when you are lost. A people's story moves along like a canoe caught in the current, being carried closer and closer to where we had begun. As I grew up, my family found again the tribal connections that had been frayed but never broken by history. We found the people who knew our true names, and when I first heard in Oklahoma the sending of thanks to the four directions at the Sunrise Lodge, the offering in the old language of the sacred tobacco, I heard it as if in my father's voice. The language was different, but the heart was the same. Ours was a solitary ceremony, but fed from the same bond with the land, founded on respect and gratitude. Now the circle drawn around us is bigger, encompassing a whole people to which we again belong. But still the offering says, "Here we are." And still I hear at the end of the words the land murmuring to itself, "Oh, here are the ones who know how to say thank you." Today, my father can speak his prayer in our language. But it was, "Here's to the gods of Tahoas," that came first, in the voice that I will always hear. It was in the presence of the ancient ceremonies that I understood that our coffee offering was not secondhand. It was ours. Much of who I am and what I do is wrapped up in my father's offering by the lakeshore. Each day still begins with a version of "Here's to the gods of Tahoas," a thanksgiving for the day. My work as an ecologist, a writer, a mother, as a traveler between scientific and traditional ways of knowing, grows from the power of those words. It reminds me of who we are. It reminds me of our gifts and our responsibility to those gifts. Ceremony is a vehicle for belonging to a family, to a people, and to the land. At last, I thought that I understood the offerings to the gods of Tahoas. It was for me the one thing that was not forgotten, that which could not be taken by history, the knowing that we belong to the land, that we were the people who knew how to say thank you. It welled up from a deep blood memory that the land, the lakes, and the spirit had held for us. But years later, with my own answer already in place, I asked my father, "Where did the ceremony come from? Did you learn it from your father and he from his? Did it stretch all the way back to the time of the canoes?" He thought for a long time. "No, I don't think so. It's just what we did. It seemed right." That was all. Some weeks went by, though, and when we spoke again, he said, "I've been thinking about the coffee and how we started giving it to the ground. You know, it was boiled coffee. There's no filter, and if it boils too hard, the grounds foam up and get stuck in the spout, so the first cup you pour would get that plug of grounds and be spoiled. I think we first did it to clear the spout." It was as if he told me that the water didn't change to wine. The whole web of gratitude, the whole story of remembrance, was nothing more than the dumping of the grounds. But you know, he said, there weren't always grounds to clear. It started out that way, but it became something else, a thought. It was a kind of respect, a kind of thanks. On a beautiful summer morning, I suppose you could call it joy. That, I think, is the power of ceremony. It marries the mundane to the sacred. The water turns to wine, the coffee to a prayer. The material and the spiritual mingle like grounds mingled with humus, transformed like steam rising from a mug into the morning mist. What else can you offer the earth, which has everything? What else can you give but something of yourself? A homemade ceremony. A ceremony that makes a home. Asters and goldenrod. The girl in the picture holds a slate with her name and class of 75 chalked in. A girl the color of deerskin, with long dark hair and inky, unreadable eyes that meet yours and won't look away. I remember that day. I was wearing the new plaid shirt that my parents had given me, an outfit I thought to be the hallmark of all foresters. When I looked back at the photo later in life, it was a puzzle to me. I recall being elated to be going to college, but there's no trace of that in the girl's face. Even before I arrived at school, I had all my answers prepared for the freshman intake interview. I wanted to make a good first impression. There were hardly any women at the forestry school in those days, and certainly none who looked like me. The advisor peered at me over his glasses and said, "So, why do you want to major in botany?" His pencil was poised over the registrar's form. How could I answer? How could I tell him that I was born a botanist? That I had shoeboxes of seeds and piles of pressed leaves under my bed, that I'd stopped my bike along the road to identify a new species, that plants colored my dreams, that the plants had chosen me. So I told him the truth. I was proud of my well-planned answer, its freshman sophistication apparent to anyone, the way I showed that I already knew some plants and their habitats, that I'd thought deeply about their nature, and was clearly well prepared for college work. I told him that I chose botany because I wanted to learn why asters and goldenrod look so beautiful together. I'm sure I was smiling then in my red plaid shirt. But he was not. He laid down his pencil as if there was no need to record what I had said. "Miss Wall," he said, fixing me with a disappointed smile, "I must tell you that that is not science. That is not at all the sort of thing with which botanists concern themselves." But he promised to put me right. "I'll enroll you in general botany so you can learn what it is." And so it began. I like to imagine that they were the first flowers I saw over my mother's shoulder as the pink blanket slipped away from my face and their colors flooded my consciousness. I've heard that early experience can attune the brain to certain stimuli so that they are processed with greater speed and certainty, so that they can be used again and again, so that we remember. Love at first sight. Through cloudy newborn eyes, their radiance formed the first botanical synapses in my wide-awake newborn brain, which until then had encountered only the blurry gentleness of pink faces. I'm guessing all eyes were on me, a little round baby, all swaddled in bunting, but mine were on goldenrod and asters. I was born to these flowers, and they came back for my birthday every year, weaving me into our mutual celebration. People flock to our hills for the fiery sweet of October, but they often miss the sublime prelude of September fields. As if harvest time were not enough, peaches, grapes, sweet corn, squash. The fields are also embroidered with drifts of golden yellow and pools of deepest purple. A masterpiece. If a fountain could jet bouquets of chrome yellow and dazzling arches of chrysanthemum fireworks, that would be Canada goldenrod. Each 3-foot stem is a geyser of tiny gold daisies, ladylike in miniature, exuberant in mass. Where the soil is damp enough, they stand side by side with their perfect counterpart, New England asters. Not the pale domesticates of the perennial border, the weak sauce of lavender or sky blue, but full-on royal purple that would make a violet shrink. The daisy-like fringe of purple petals surrounds a disk as bright as the sun at high noon, a golden-orange pool, just a tantalizing shade darker than the surrounding goldenrod. Alone, each is a botanical superlative. Together, the visual effect is stunning. Purple and gold, the heraldic colors of the king and queen of the meadow, a regal procession in complementary colors. I just wanted to know why. Why do they stand beside each other when they could grow alone? Why this particular pair? There are plenty of pinks and whites and blues dotting the fields. So is it only happenstance that the magnificence of purple and gold end up side by side? Einstein himself said that God doesn't play dice with the universe. What is the source of this pattern? Why is the world so beautiful? It could so easily be otherwise. Flowers could be ugly to us and still fulfill their own purpose, but they're not. It seemed like a good question to me, but my advisor said, it's not science, not what botany was about. I wanted to know why certain stems bent easily for baskets and some would break, why the biggest berries grew in the shade, and why they made us medicines, which plants are edible, why those little pink orchids only grow under pines. Not science, he said. And he ought to know, sitting in his laboratory, a learned professor of botany. And if you want to study beauty, you should go to art school. He reminded me of my deliberations over choosing a college when I had vacillated between training as a botanist or as a poet. Since everybody told me I couldn't do both, I'd chosen plants. He told me that science was not about beauty, not about the embrace between plants and humans. I had no rejoinder. I had made a mistake. There was no fight in me, only embarrassment at my error. I didn't have the words for resistance. He signed me up for my classes, and I was dismissed to go get my photo taken for registration. I didn't think about it at the time, but it was happening all over again. An echo of my grandfather's first day at school, when he was ordered to leave everything, language, culture, family, behind. The professor made me doubt where I came from, what I knew, and claimed that his was the right way to think. Only he didn't cut my hair off. In moving from a childhood in the woods to the university, I had unknowingly shifted between worldviews. From a natural history of experience, in which I knew plants as teachers and companions to whom I was linked with mutual responsibility, into the realm of science. The questions science raised were not who are you, but what is it? No one asked plants, what can you tell us? The primary question was, how does it work? The botany I was taught was reductionist, mechanistic, and strictly objective. Plants were reduced to objects, they were not subjects. The way botany was conceived and taught didn't seem to leave much room for a person who thought the way I did. The only way I could make sense of it was to conclude that the things I had always believed about plants must not be true after all. That first plant science class was a disaster. I barely scraped by with a C and could not muster much enthusiasm for memorizing the concentrations of essential plant nutrients. There were times when I wanted to quit, but the more I learned, the more fascinated I became with the intricate structures that made up a leaf and the alchemy of photosynthesis. Companionship between asters and goldenrod was never mentioned, but I memorized botanical Latin as if it was poetry, eagerly tossing aside the name goldenrod for Solidago canadensis. I was mesmerized by plant ecology, evolution, taxonomy, physiology, soils, and fungi. All around me were my good teachers, the plants. I found good mentors, too, warm and kind professors who were doing heart-driven science, whether they could admit it or not. They, too, were my teachers. And yet there was always something tapping at my shoulder, willing me to turn around. When I did not know how to recognize what stood behind me. My natural inclination was to see relationships, to seek the threads that connect the world, to join instead of divide. But science is rigorous in separating the observer from the observed, and the observed from the observer. Why two flowers are beautiful together would violate the division necessary for objectivity. I scarcely doubted the primacy of scientific thought. Following the path of science trained me to separate, to distinguish perception from physical reality, to atomize complexity into its smallest components, to honor the chain of evidence and logic, to discern one thing from another, to savor the pleasure of precision. The more I did this, the better I got at it, and was accepted to do graduate work in one of the world's finest botany programs. No doubt on the strength of the letter of recommendation from my advisor, which read, "She's done remarkably well for an Indian girl." A master's degree, a PhD, and a faculty position followed. I am grateful for the knowledge that was shared with me and deeply privileged to carry the powerful tools of science as a way of engaging the world. It took me to other plant communities, far from the asters and goldenrod. I remember feeling, as a new faculty member, as if I finally understood plants. I, too, began to teach the mechanics of botany, emulating the approach that I had been taught. It reminds me of a story told by my friend Holly Youngbear Tibbetts. A plant scientist, armed with his notebooks and equipment, is exploring the rainforest for new botanical discoveries, and he has hired an indigenous guide to lead him. Knowing the scientist's interests, the young guide takes care to point out the interesting species. The botanist looks at him appraisingly, surprised by his capacity. "Well, well, young man, you certainly know the names of a lot of these plants." The guide nods and replies with downcast eyes, "Yes, I've learned the names of all the bushes, but I have yet to learn their songs." I was teaching the names and ignoring the songs. When I was in graduate school in Wisconsin, my then husband and I had the good fortune to land jobs as caretakers at the University Arboretum. In return for a little house at the edge of the prairie, we had only to make the nighttime rounds, checking that doors and gates were secure before we left the darkness to the crickets. There was just one time that a light was left burning, a door left ajar, in the horticulture garage. There was no mischief, but as my husband checked around, I stood and idly scanned the bulletin board. There was a news clipping there with a photo of a magnificent American elm which had just been named the champion for its species, the largest of its kind. It had a name, the Louisville Elm. My heart began to pound, and I knew my world was about to change, for I'd known the name Louisville all my life, and here was his face looking at me from a news clipping. He was our Potawatomi grandfather, one who had walked all the way from the Wisconsin forests to the Kansas prairie with my grandma, Shawnoda. He was a leader, one who took care of the people in their hardship. That garage door was left ajar. That light was left burning, and it shone on the path back home for me. It was the beginning of a long, slow journey back to my people, called out to me by the tree that stood above their bones. To walk the science path, I had stepped off the path of indigenous knowledge. But the world has a way of guiding your steps. Seemingly out of the blue came an invitation to a small gathering of native elders to talk about traditional knowledge of plants. One I will never forget, a Navajo woman, without a day of university botany training in her life, spoke for hours, and I hung on every word. One by one, name by name, she told of the plants in her valley, where each one lived, when it bloomed, who it liked to live near, and all of its relationships, who ate it, who lined their nests with its fibers, what kind of medicine it offered. She also shared the stories held by those plants, their origin myths, how they got their names, and what they have to tell us. She spoke of beauty. Her words were like smelling salts, waking me to what I had known back when I was picking strawberries. I realized how shallow my understanding was. Her knowledge was so much deeper and wider and engaged all the human ways of understanding. She could have explained asters and goldenrod. To a new PhD, this was humbling. It was the beginning of my reclaiming that other way of knowing that I had helplessly let science supplant. I felt like a malnourished refugee invited to a feast, the dishes scented with the herbs of home. I circled right back to where I had begun, to the question of beauty, back to the questions that science does not ask, not because they aren't important, but because science as a way of knowing is too narrow for the task. Had my advisor been a better scholar, he would have celebrated my questions, not dismissed them. He offered me only the cliché that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And since science separates the observer and the observed, by definition, beauty could not be a valid scientific question. I should have been told that my questions were bigger than science could touch. He was right about beauty being in the eye of the beholder, especially when it comes to purple and yellow. Color perception in humans relies on banks of specialized receptor cells, the rods and cones in the retina. The job of the cone cells is to absorb light of different wavelengths and pass it on to the brain's visual cortex, where it can be interpreted. The visible light spectrum, the rainbow of colors, is broad, so the most effective means of discerning color is not one generalized jack-of-all-trades cone cell, but rather an array of specialists, each perfectly tuned to absorb certain wavelengths. The human eye has three kinds. One type excels at detecting red and associated wavelengths. One is tuned to blue. The other optimally perceives light of two colors, purple and yellow. The human eye is superbly equipped to detect these colors and send a signal pulsing to the brain. This doesn't explain why I perceive them as beautiful, but it does explain why that combination gets my undivided attention. I asked my artist buddies about the power of purple and gold, and they sent me right to the color wheel. These two were complementary colors, as different in nature as could be. In composing a palette, putting them together makes each more vivid. Just a touch of one will bring out the other. In an 1890 treatise on color perception, Goethe, who was both a scientist and a poet, wrote that the colors diametrically opposed to each other are those which reciprocally evoke each other in the eye. Purple and yellow are a reciprocal pair. Our eyes are so sensitive to these wavelengths that the cones can get oversaturated and the stimulus pours over onto the other cells. A printmaker I know showed me that if you stare for a long time at a block of yellow and then shift your gaze to a white sheet of paper, you will see it for a moment as violet. This phenomenon, the colored afterimage, occurs because there is energetic reciprocity between purple and yellow pigments, which goldenrod and asters knew well before we did. If my advisor was correct, the visual effect that so delights a human like me may be irrelevant to the flowers. The real beholder whose eyes they hope to catch is a bee bent on pollination. Bees perceive many flowers differently than humans do, due to their perception of additional spectra, such as ultraviolet radiation. As it turns out, though, goldenrod and asters appear very similarly to bee eyes and human eyes. We both think they're beautiful. Their striking contrast when they grow together makes them the most attractive target in the whole meadow, a beacon for bees. Growing together, both receive more pollinator visits than they would if they were growing alone. It's a testable hypothesis. It's a question of science, a question of art, and a question of beauty. Why are they beautiful together? It is a phenomenon simultaneously material and spiritual, for which we need all wavelengths, for which we need depth perception. When I stare too long at the world with science eyes, I see an afterimage of traditional knowledge. Might science and traditional knowledge be purple and yellow to one another? Might they be goldenrod and asters? We see the world more fully when we use both. The question of goldenrod and asters was, of course, just emblematic of what I really wanted to know. It was an architecture of relationships, of connections, that I yearned to understand. I wanted to see the shimmering threads that hold it all together. And I wanted to know why we love the world. Why the most ordinary scrap of meadow can rock us back on our heels in awe. When botanists go walking the forests and fields looking for plants, we say they are going on a foray. When writers do the same, we should call it a metaphoray, and the land is rich in both. We need them both. Scientist and poet Jeffrey Burton Russell writes that as the sign of a deeper truth, metaphor was close to sacrament, because the vastness and richness of reality cannot be expressed by the overt sense of a statement alone. Native scholar Greg Cajete has written that in indigenous ways of knowing, we understand a thing only when we understand it with all four aspects of our being, mind, body, emotion, and spirit. I came to understand quite sharply when I began my training as a scientist that science privileges only one, possibly two, of those ways of knowing, mind and body. As a young person wanting to know everything about plants, I did not question this. But it is a whole human being who finds the beautiful path. There was a time when I teetered precariously with an awkward foot in each of two worlds, the scientific and the indigenous. But then I learned to fly, or at least try. It was the bees that showed me how to move between different flowers, to drink the nectar and gather pollen from both. It is this dance of cross-pollination that can produce a new species of knowledge, a new way of being in the world. After all, there aren't two worlds. There is just this one good green earth. That September pairing of purple and gold is lived reciprocity. Its wisdom is that the beauty of one is illuminated by the radiance of the other. Science and art, matter and spirit, indigenous knowledge and Western science. Can they be goldenrod and asters for each other? When I am in their presence, their beauty asks me for reciprocity, to be the complementary color, to make something beautiful in response. Learning the grammar of animacy. To be native to a place, we must learn to speak its language. I come here to listen, to nestle in the curve of the roots in a soft hollow of pine needles, to lean my bones against the column of white pine, to turn off the voice in my head until I can hear the voices outside it, the shh of wind in needles, water trickling over rock, nuthatch tapping, chipmunks digging, beechnut falling, mosquito in my ear, and something more. Something that is not me, for which we have no language, the wordless being of others in which we are never alone. After the drumbeat of my mother's heart, this was my first language. I could spend a whole day listening, and a whole night, and in the morning, without my hearing it, there might be a mushroom that was not there the night before, creamy white, pushed up from the pine needle duff, out of darkness to light, still glistening with the fluid of its passage. Papoe. Listening in wild places, we are audience to conversations in a language not our own. I think now that it was a longing to comprehend this language I hear in the woods that led me to science, to learn over the years to speak fluent botany, a tongue that should not, by the way, be mistaken for the language of plants. I did learn another language in science, though, one of careful observation, an intimate vocabulary that names each little part. To name and describe you must first see, and science polishes the gift of seeing. I honor the strength of the language that has become a second tongue to me. But beneath the richness of its vocabulary and its descriptive power, something is missing. The same something that swells around you and in you when you listen to the world. Science can be a language of distance, which reduces a being to its working parts. It is a language of objects. The language scientists speak, however precise, is based on a profound error in grammar, an omission, a grave loss in translation from the native languages of these shores. My first taste of the missing language was the word Papoe on my tongue. I stumbled upon it in a book by the Anishinaabe ethnobotanist, Kiwetinokwe, in a treatise on the traditional uses of fungi by our people. Papoe, she explained, translates as the force which causes mushrooms to push up from the earth overnight. As a biologist, I was stunned that such a word existed. In all its technical vocabulary, Western science has no such term, no words to hold this mystery. You'd think that biologists of all people would have words for life. But in scientific language, our terminology is used to define the boundaries of our knowing. What lies beyond our grasp remains unnamed. In the three syllables of this new word, I could see an entire process of close observation in the damp morning woods. The formation of a theory for which English has no equivalent. The makers of this word understood a world of being, full of unseen energies that animate everything. I've cherished it for many years, as a talisman, and longed for the people who gave a name to the life force of mushrooms. The language that holds Papoe is one that I wanted to speak. So when I learned that the word for rising, for emergence, belonged to the language of my ancestors, it became a signpost for me. Had history been different, I would likely speak Borewabmimwen, or Potawatomi, an Anishinaabe language. But like many of the 350 indigenous languages of the Americas, Potawatomi is threatened, and I speak the language that you read. The powers of assimilation did their work, as my chance of hearing that language, and yours too, was washed from the mouths of Indian children in government boarding schools where speaking your native tongue was forbidden. Children like my grandfather, who was taken from his family when he was just a little boy of 9 years old. This history scattered not only our words, but also our people. Today I live far from our reservation, so even if I could speak the language, I would have no one to talk to. But a few summers ago, at our yearly tribal gathering, a language class was held, and I slipped into the tent to listen. There was a great deal of excitement about the class, because for the first time, every single fluent speaker in our tribe would be there as a teacher. When the speakers were called forward to the circle of folding chairs, they moved slowly, with canes, walkers, and wheelchairs, only a few entirely under their own power. I counted them as they filled the chairs. 9. 9 fluent speakers in the whole world. Our language, millennia in the making, sits in those 9 chairs. The words that praised creation, told the old stories, lulled my ancestors to sleep, rest today in the tongues of 9 very mortal men and women. Each in turn addresses the small group of would-be students. A man with long gray braids tells us how his mother hid him away when the Indian agents came to take the children. He escaped boarding school by hiding under an overhung bank where the sound of the stream covered his crying. The others were all taken and had their mouths washed out with soap, or worse, for talking that dirty Indian language. Because he alone stayed home and was raised up calling the plants and animals by the name Creator gave them, he is here today, a carrier of the language. The engines of assimilation worked well. The speaker's eyes blaze as he tells us, "We're the end of the road. We are all that is left. If you young people do not learn, the language will die. The missionaries and the U.S. government will have their victory at last." A great-grandmother from the circle pushes her walker up close to the microphone. "It's not just the words that will be lost," she says. "The language is the heart of our culture. It holds our thoughts, our way of seeing the world. It's too beautiful for English to explain." Papoey. Jim Thunder, at 75, the youngest of the speakers, is a round brown man of serious demeanor, who spoke only in Potawatomi. He began solemnly, but as he warmed to his subject, his voice lifted like a breeze in the birch trees, and his hands began to tell the story. He became more and more animated, rising to his feet, holding us rapt and silent, although almost no one understood a single word. He paused as if reaching the climax of his story and looked out at the audience with a twinkle of expectation. One of the grandmothers behind him covered her mouth in a giggle, and his stern face suddenly broke into a smile as big and sweet as a cracked watermelon. He bent over laughing, and the grandmas dabbed away tears of laughter, holding their sides, while the rest of us looked on in wonderment. When the laughter subsided, he spoke at last in English. "What will happen to a joke when no one can hear it anymore? How lonely those words will be when their power is gone. Where will they go? Off to join the stories that can never be told again." So now my house is spangled with post-it notes in another language, as if I were studying for a trip abroad. But I'm not going away. I'm coming home. "Nipija ezyayin?" asked the little yellow sticky note on my back door. My hands are full and the car is running, but I switch my bag to the other hip and pause long enough to respond. "Odanek nadezhia." I'm going to town. So I do. To work, to class, to meetings, to the bank, to the grocery store. I talk all day and sometimes write all evening in the beautiful language I was born to, the same one used by 70% of the world's people, a tongue viewed as the most useful, with the richest vocabulary in the modern world, English. When I get home at night to my quiet house, there is a faithful post-it note on the closet door, Gisken I Gabiskoagen. And so I take off my coat. I cook dinner, pulling utensils from cupboards labeled Emquanen, Nagen. I've become a woman who speaks Potawatomi to household objects. When the phone rings, I barely glance at the post-it there as I dopen in the Geektagon. And whether it's a solicitor or a friend, they speak English. Once a week or so, it is my sister from the West Coast who says, Bonjour, mokche wenkwe nada, as if she needed to identify herself. Who else speaks Potawatomi? To call it speaking is a stretch. Really, all we do is blurt garbled phrases to each other in a parody of conversation. How are you? I am fine. Go to town. See bird. Red. Fry bread good. We sound like Tonto's side of the Hollywood dialogue with the Lone Ranger. Me try talk good Injun way. On the rare occasion when we can actually string together a halfway coherent thought, we freely insert high school Spanish words to fill in the gaps, making a language we call Spanawatomi. Tuesdays and Thursdays at 12:15 Oklahoma time, I join the Potawatomi lunchtime language class, streaming from tribal headquarters via the internet. There are usually about 10 of us from all over the country. Together we learn to count and to say pass the salt. Someone asks, how do you say please pass the salt? Our teacher, Justin Neely, a young man devoted to language revival, explains that while there are several words for thank you, there is no word for please. Food was meant to be shared. No added politeness is needed. It was simply a cultural given that one was asking respectfully. The missionaries took this absence as further evidence of crude manners. Many nights, when I should be grading papers or paying bills, I'm at the computer running through Potawatomi language drills. After months, I have mastered the kindergarten vocabulary and can confidently match the pictures of animals to their indigenous names. It reminds me of reading picture books to my children. Can you point to the squirrel? Where is the bunny? All the while I'm telling myself that I really don't have time for this, and what's more, little need to know the words for bass and fox anyway. Since our tribal diaspora left us scattered to the four winds, who would I talk to? The simple phrases I'm learning are perfect for my dog. Sit, eat, come here, be quiet. But since she scarcely responds to these commands in English, I'm reluctant to train her to be bilingual. An admiring student once asked me if I spoke my native language. I was tempted to say, oh yes, we speak Potawatomi at home. Me, the dog, and the post-it notes. Our teacher tells us not to be discouraged and thanks us every time a word is spoken. Thanks us for breathing life into the language, even if we only speak a single word. But I have no one to talk to, I complain. None of us do, he reassures me. But someday we will. So I dutifully learn the vocabulary, but find it hard to see the heart of our culture in translating bed and sink into Potawatomi. Learning nouns was pretty easy. After all, I'd learned thousands of botanical Latin names and scientific terms. I realized that this could not be too much different. Just a one-for-one substitution, memorization. At least on paper, where you can see the letters, this is true. Hearing the language is a different story. There are fewer letters in our alphabet, so the distinction among words for a beginner is often subtle. With the beautiful clusters of consonants of zh and mb and shwe and kwe and mushk, our language sounds like wind in the pines and water over rocks, sounds our ears may have been more delicately attuned to in the past, but no longer. To learn again, you really have to listen. To actually speak, of course, requires verbs. And here is where my kindergarten proficiency at naming things leaves off. English is a noun-based language, somehow appropriate to a culture so obsessed with things. Only 30% of English words are verbs, but in Potawatomi, that proportion is 70%, which means that 70% of the words have to be conjugated and 70% have different tenses and cases to be mastered. European languages often assign gender to nouns, but Potawatomi does not divide the world into masculine and feminine. Nouns and verbs both are animate and inanimate. You hear a person with a word that is completely different from the one with which you hear an airplane. Pronouns, articles, plurals, demonstratives, verbs, all those syntactical bits I could never keep straight in high school English are all aligned in Potawatomi to provide different ways to speak of the living world and the lifeless one. Different verb forms, different plurals, different everything apply depending on whether what you are speaking of is alive. No wonder there are only 9 speakers left. I try, but the complexity makes my head hurt, and my ear can barely distinguish between words that mean completely different things. One teacher reassures us that this will come with practice, but another elder concedes that these close similarities are inherent in the language. As Stuart King, a knowledge keeper and great teacher, reminds us, the Creator meant for us to laugh, so humor is deliberately built into the syntax. Even a small slip of the tongue can convert, "We need more firewood," to "Take off your clothes." In fact, I learned that the mystical word, papoe, is used not only for mushrooms, but also for certain other shafts that rise